This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine. Welcome to Progressive Radio. Today we're going to be talking about the power of the Internet, the problems of the Democratic Party, and how one might be part of the cure of the other. With me to talk about this are two giants of the blogosphere, Marcos Moulitsis of Daily Kos, of course, and Jerome Armstrong of MyDD.com. They're the co-authors of the new book, Crashing the Gate, Netroots, Grassroots, The Rise of People-Powered Politics. Marcos and Jerome, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Glad to be here.
Thanks, Matt.
Let's just go back to the beginning briefly and tell me, each of you, how you got your start in blogging.
Sure. I'll start. MyDD came on the scene in 2001 and was one of the early political blogs that was out there. And what was unique about to me was the experience of learning about other people. And it seems kind of trivial now, but learning from other people all around the nation that were, you know, had the same thoughts I did, and understanding that this was a medium that transcended any borders or experience or anything that you might have had up to that point.
And Marcos, you?
Yeah, I was. This is after 2000, and I was desperately looking for progressive voices, partisan liberal voices in the media landscape, and they're very much non-existent, definitely not on television, not on radio. So the Internet became kind of the holy grail for people like me, desperate for this sort of news and information and voices. And I came across Jerome's site. I came across MyDD. I began commenting on that site, and that is essentially what inspired me to start writing and creating my own site, Daily Kos.
So, Jerome, you're the father of Marcos in a way. Then.
Yeah, the blog father is the acronym. And then we started, you know, we wound up engaging with Howard Dean early on in 2003 and working with Trippy with the whole Dean movement. And so that was sort of segued into having front row seats to a lot of the political changes that have happened.
How did Trippy connect with you right away?
He read the blogs, and he was reading a blog, some of the things I was writing on MyDD, and reached out to me, emailed me, and said,
"Well, why? Because you trashed him."
Yeah, because I was trashing him, calling him an idiot.
And did he respond on the
blog?
Yeah,
he was like, "Look, help me out, man."
And were you officially with the Dean campaign or unofficially?
Yeah, no, I went into Burlington, the national headquarters, and worked there for campaign.
And was the campaign really responsive to bloggers after that initial bit of response, or was there less there than met the eye?
No, there was. It was blog driven in many ways. The strategy was to figure out right away how we could marshal these huge forces that were happening on the Internet, and we were lucky that, you know, I was able to find a meetup and bring that into the campaign and allowed people to organize all around the nation, and that's actually kept on going with groups like Democracy for America and Democracy for Wisconsin here.
Any hindsight on the Dean collapse?
We talked about it a lot last night, and it's I think it's a conglomeration of a lot of different events, but most of all, it was a huge success in many ways. We took a guy who was an asterisk and put him into a front runner. He wasn't able to close the deal, but that doesn't negate the success we had.
Been talking with Jerome Armstrong of MyDD.com. It's Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Also here in the studio with me is Marcos of Daily Kos. Marcos, the Dean phenomenon then led in part to Dean becoming head of the Democratic National Committee. What role did the blog play there?
We really played a critical role, actually. Since there wasn't a lot of people interested in covering something as inside baseball as who's going to run the Democratic Party, the bloggers really took a role in becoming kind of sort of information central for this race.
And the standard Democratic Party honchos didn't want Howard Dean.
Well, you know, first of all, Kerry came in and he tried to imperially decide it. He said Tom Vilsack, and we laughed and we said, "Yeah, no, it's not going to happen." So Tom Vilsack realized, and he's governor of Iowa, realized, "Well, I'm not going to get it by fiat, so I'm not going to go through the trouble of running." So he dropped out, and then Kerry tried to put Jean Shaheen, who used to be the governor of New Hampshire. And she got shot down, so she dropped out. And it was kind of interesting because there was a whole succession of establishment candidates that were kind of put up, and we absolutely walloped them and shoot them down.
Yeah, we had put on the blogs the day after the election, Howard Dean is going to be on the DNC chair. There was, you know, that we threw down the gauntlet on the blogs the next day after the election.
And how many people did you have on the net, you know, clamoring for Dean?
Everybody was.
Yeah, it was.
So, but what's the size of everybody?
Oh, about a million or so?
Yeah, maybe about a million.
Yeah.
No problem. That's just a magazine falling.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, yeah, it's one of the better uses of the Progressive magazine.
But you know, it was we basically said we're going to support progressive or reform candidates, candidates that still are going to do the same old, are not wanted. We're not going to stand for it. And there were two candidates at the time that, that really were reform candidates, and that was Howard Dean and Simon Rosenberg, who ran an organization called the New Democrat Network. And Simon is a great guy, but obviously he didn't have the stature and the in the level of support that Howard Dean did. So Howard Dean became our de facto choice. He was going to be it. Or, you know, it's kind of one of those over our dead bodies, anybody else, right? And
it was both ways, too. There was a lot of quotes from consultants over my dead body that Howard Dean would become the DNC chair. So it really was a battle for the soul of the Democratic Party in many ways.
And one of the critiques you have in your book, Crashing the Gate, is that these consultants, these people, these poobahs, the Democratic Party, if you will, have just had way too much power and have been unaccountable, even after they lose and lose and lose.
Yeah, they Republicans treat their consultants like hired help, which is what they really should be. We treat consultants like equals, like they're part of the team. And you know, in a lot of ways, maybe that'd be fine if they were winning and there were actually results. But essentially, we have a cabal, unaccountable cabal, this Beltway Mafia that runs the party, runs the campaigns, controls the message of the party, and they just kind of do this musical chairs things. For one year, they're running the DNC. The next year, they're consulting, and they just kind of move consulting agreements and contracts to each other. So there's no way for new voices, new effective consultants to break into this little old boys network. And you know, again, if they were winning, you know, we wouldn't have a problem with it. But they're not,
In your book, Marcos and Jerome, you guys mentioned that when Republicans lose an election, they shoot the consultant or the campaign manager or the pollster, and the Democrats they never do it. And then you cite the example, of course, of Bob Shrum, who ran Kerry's campaign and lost for the seventh or eighth time.
Yeah, part of it is what Marcos is alluding to, that the candidates and politicians within the Democratic Party rely upon our consultants much more. There was a whole movement away from the party that happened in the 70s that really put the basis of power into how are you going to formulate the message for the candidate over television. And it decimated the Democratic Party as it struggled as an organization throughout the nation. And in many ways, what we're doing through the internet is reviving the Democratic Party at the very local level.
Well, how are you doing that?
Well, things like, I think this is a growth of out of Meetup, where people were able to put in their zip codes and find out how to get into an organization locally. And what we advocate for that to happen is for people to find out, you know, at the very local level of precincts, how do you get involved with the Democratic Party at a precinct? Throughout the nation, there's many places in rural America where there's absolutely nobody in the Democratic Party organization.
I mean, this is where what Dean is doing now, or said he was going to do as head of the DNC, and what you guys are advocating and Crashing the Gate run right together, which is 50 state. You know, every county, every district, we're going to have a presence. Is Dean living up to that, by the way?
So far, so good. I mean, you know, he's been there a little bit over a year, so there's a lot of work left to be done. But you hear a lot of people in D.C. are really angry at Dean, and that's because these are consultants that are used to the party taking money from the states, siphoning money away from the states to D.C., where the consultants can then blow it away on television ads. So finally, Dean is actually investing in the states. He has paid staff in every single state. In many states, we didn't even have, as a party, we didn't have anybody to even answer the phone. Now we have paid staffers in every single state. And It was Charlie Cook who went down to Mississippi because people were complaining about why is Dean spending money in Mississippi when we don't have any contested elections this year. Charlie Cook went down. He said, a year ago, I was down in Mississippi. There was no Democratic Party on the ground. It just did not exist. Now there's a Democratic presence in every single precinct in the state. And Trent Lott could have retired this year. He could have retired. He did not. But in 6 years, when he does retire, we're going to have a ground operation that can actually fight the right wing, their ground operation, where before we didn't have anything.
You going to predict a victory right now, Marcos?
Absolutely not.
Can't pin it down on that.
I'll predict a victory in 2016.
Okay.
I think we're looking good for 2016.
I mean, Jerome, I mean, back to the consultants for a second. I mean, one thing that struck me as I was reading your book was remembering that two of my favorite senators, Russ Feingold here from Wisconsin, and of course Wellstone from Minnesota, won their elections with very non-traditional, non-Washington consultants. And also the governor of Montana, Schweitzer, too, has done it that way.
Yeah.
What is the moral of that story?
Well, the moral is we need to decentralize out of D.C. and get it out from this old boys network that's going on there. And I think that's going to happen. The internet actually facilitates that as well, because this sort of information gets out there much more rapidly. People who are in the states that are more effective, word gets out. You know, Ned Lamont's a good example. He's a challenger that we have in Connecticut. He actually just hired...
To Joe Lieberman.
Yeah, again, challenger.
And I know Lieberman. A lot of progressives around the country are praying for Joe Lieberman's
defeat. He actually just hired Hillsman as admin in many ways because of we popularized him.
And Bill Hillsman was a guy who worked on Paul Wellstone's stuff.
Marcos always likes to fill in the details.
Yeah. Joe assumes everybody knows who Bill Hillsman is. You know, there's a great story in the book that I just loved. We talked to Brad Carson, who ran for Senate in Oklahoma. Tough state, very Republican. You don't win as a Democrat statewide in Oklahoma unless you do things a little bit more creatively, right?
And he's running against Coburn, who is this crazy right wing.
Oh, crazy, beyond
wants
crazy.
Wants to kill doctors who perform adoptions. Really, wants to abortions. Wants to kill.
That's logical.
Wants to execute doctors.
He wanted to hire Steve Eichenbaum, who was the media guy
personally.
For Russ Feingold. Right. Great guy, very creative advertising, very different. The party in D.C. said, if you want our millions, you cannot hire Eichenbaum. You're going to have to hire one of our guys. And so basically, they twisted his arm. He fought as much as he could, but he needed those millions of dollars. Finally, he had to concede, and the D.C. people came in, and they ran a traditional cookie-cutter media campaign. Of course, he lost.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. I'm delighted to have in the studio with me today two of the leaders of the progressive blogosphere. Marcos of Daily Coast and Jerome Armstrong of MyDD.com. McCain-Feingold. In your book, you make the interesting point about the importance of McCain-Feingold, not just in a kind of a general reformist good government way, but in a particular way. Tell me why you think that's important. I was reminded reading the book of Hillary Clinton, who was screaming on the Senate floor in a hallway of the Senate at Russ Feingold for basically not having his head in the real world because he was taking the big money out of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, we viewed it as crossing the Rubicon for the Democratic Party because at that moment they were going to rely upon the people again. And whereas they saw, you know, the consultants and Hillary Clinton saw this meant the death for the Democratic Party, we really actually saw it as a moment of hope because the Democratic Party would have to return to the people and rely upon small donor donations rather than these huge soft money donations of millions of dollars. And, you know, right after that was the rise of Howard Dean. And so it sort of became this two-step process of looking at it from a historical perspective of this was really the moment when the structure of how candidates raise funds dramatically changed and is starting to reform the party.
Yeah, we progressives kind of look at the Republicans with a lot of envy and say, man, the Republican Party really is responsive to its people. Why can't Democrats be that way? The reason was because the Republican Party has been funded by small dollar donations for a long time. They have to be responsive to their people if they want to keep that money coming. Democrats were only responsive to millionaires and billionaires who funded the party. So that's going to change now because campaign finance reform is changing that.
It's odd because the, you know, people on the left, on the progressive side, say, you know, the Republicans are the party of big money. They're responsible.
That's the big irony. That is the big irony.
Well, the Democrats have always, you know, held that out as why we didn't win. You know, the Republicans always have more money to us every single election. In 2004, that wasn't the case. We had just as much money as they did based upon small donors.
Well, Jerome, what happened in 2004 then?
Well, we lost, obviously, not because of money. We lost because of the things that we point out in the book, and this had to deal with the special interest groups not working together as a movement. We had all these different issue groups, like in Ohio, doing the same task on top of each other, not really working in a coordinated way. We had consultants that were using practices that were, you know, they had performed in the 80s and 90s of just using broadcast television, not using cable, not using radio, not using the internet effectively. When the media now is much more fragmented, to reach people beyond television, you have to use these other media. And also the Republicans have built up through the last couple of decades a huge propaganda machine that we just don't have on the left.
So it sounds to me like you think the problem was more of technique and strategy than, say, the flaws of the candidate.
Go ahead, Marcus.
The infrastructure, I mean, when we talk about that, a lot of that, the lack of message is because of the techniques and strategies we're using, the lack of a machine in order to create our message and to market our message and to close a deal on election
day. Was it the lack of a machine that or the infrastructure that made Kerry at the Grand Canyon say, you know, he'd still vote the same way today?
Even if he had...
About the Iraq War?
We might not have still won. I mean, well, that was a structural flaw of him, of not being able to realize that that was the major distinction of the election.
But they have a media machine that could really amplify that as well. Yeah. And we didn't have a machine to push back and say, this is what he really meant. Now, George Bush has said many worse things than what Kerry said at the Grand Canyon. But we don't have the ability to amplify that because we don't have a machinery in place, a partisan machine, to do that sort of thing.
Well, there's been a lot of talk and some effort over the last 4 years anyway, 2 years in particular, but I know I've been engaged in conversations about this for 10 years or more, about how to build this echo chamber, how the left or the progressives or left-wing, the Democratic Party, whoever, need to, you know, play in the media field and need to get wise and need to amplify each other's messages. Where does that stand right now? Are we beyond the talking stage?
Well, yeah, I think we are in terms of how the blogosphere is being used by progressives. Because what we are able to do on the blogs is realize what the Republicans are trying to push out as their meme on a daily basis, rapid response. We can do it right over the internet. Now, through reaching millions of people, we just had a poll come out that showed the Democrats, 10 million Democrats are reading blogs on a regular basis.
Yeah, and big money's starting to really come in. I mean, there's several groups of millionaires and billionaires that are pumping money into the infrastructure of the party. They're building the think tanks. They're building the media institutions. So it's starting to happen. You know, we write in the book that while, you know, there was a big irony that while Republicans were celebrating George Bush's victory in 2004, that actually marked the end of the modern conservative movement, because that was the final signal to progressives and a lot of, you know, rank-and-file progressives, and even the big-money people, that this wasn't a question of the pendulum swinging this way or that way. There was real disadvantage, and that even though Kerry should have won the election, by all the numbers, he should have won the election, that there was a reason he lost, and that's because we were at a gross disadvantage in the structural level.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. That was Marcos of Daily Coast just talking, and prior to him, Jerome Armstrong of MyDD.com. They're both in the studio with me here on Progressive Radio. They've got a new book out, quite a provocative book, called Crashing the Gate, Netroots, Grassroots, The Rise of People-Powered Politics. Talk to me a little bit more of your critique, not of strategy, tactics, amplification, etc., media and messaging, but of special interest groups, so-called.
Yeah, that's you know, it's kind of been amazing to me. It's been quite a trip, because a year ago I started writing about how we as a movement are so fragmented that we hurt each other. We're so fixated on my issue, my issue, my issue, that we don't realize that by working together, even for flawed candidates, flawed Democrats, that if we had a Democratic majority, all our issues would be better served than the current Republican administration that's hell-bent on destroying everything we care about and believe in. A year ago, this was very, very controversial. I got beat up pretty badly. I was going after NARAL for endorsing Lincoln Chafee, Republican in Rhode Island, to kind of, you know, set the whole stage for this whole battle. A year later now, I think it's becoming more and more conventional wisdom. The Republicans are very united. They work together, even if it's not their issue. You hear the Christian Coalition talking about tax cuts and the NRA talking about tax cuts. They all get their turn. They all realize that a Republican in power is going to be much friendlier to their agenda than Democrats will be. Our side still hasn't learned that lesson, and I think little by little we're starting to learn it. But just last week, the Sierra Club endorsed Lincoln Chafee as well. So,
but what do you do about, you know, NARAL and Lincoln Chafee? I mean, Lincoln Chafee's been a big supporter of abortion rights, or you could do
he hasn't been a big supporter of – he says he's a big supporter of abortion rights, and he'll vote – he'll make these symbolic votes with the big Republican majority that don't matter. But on Alito, he voted for cloture. On every single one of George Bush's other judges, including Janice Roger Brown, who's one of the most reactionary right-wing judges on the appeals court, Lincoln Chafee has enabled that. So he may cast a meaningless vote, you know, for a choice issue, but he's also put in judges for 30, 40, 50 years that are going to be ruling against that issue. So,
it's short-sighted even on their own issue.
Absolutely. He is enabling a party that is hell-bent on destroying choice, hell-bent on destroying the environment. And his vote, because they are in such a majority, his votes are meaningless.
Jerome, do you want to pursue that with the Pennsylvania race right now with Casey?
With Casey, it's just, I think, more the same. You have interest groups that are looking at their issue alone. And, you know, in talking with them about this issue, brought up what Marcos was talking about, and one of the representatives from the group told me that we have other groups that take care of the judges. And so they actually view this, it's a mentality and a worldview that thinks of the progressive movement as separate issues that each one of these groups are responsible for, and there's not a cohesive world understanding of that within that. And I think, you know, what we've seen, the movements that have come up in this decade, and this is groups like Democracy for America and Progressive Democrats of America, that there's much more of an understanding that we can't just work on one issue and that alone. We have to realize that there's many different issues we're working on, and it's part of a broader progressive movement.
And you know, the thing is, we're not talking theory either. We went to Colorado, one of the two states that saw dramatic, one of the three states that saw dramatic gains at the state level in 2000.
What were the other two?
Montana and Minnesota.
Okay, so and what you see in Colorado?
Colorado, the issue groups realized that they were hurting themselves by working at odds with each other. So they came together, and first of all, they split duties with the party. The party was in charge of message. The party was in charge of candidate recruitment. But the issue groups then took care of the field operation. They did not get involved in message. They just turned people out, and they apportioned the state. So there was no overlap. They weren't fighting each other. And they supported candidates that weren't perfect on their issues. So there may have been an anti-choice candidate, but NARA was going to still work to get out the vote for that candidate, knowing that now, with a Democratic majority, they targeted 16 seats. We won 15 of them, most of them in Republican districts. Now we have a Republican or a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate, and that anti-choice legislation ain't going to see the light of day. Anti-environment legislation won't see the light of day, no matter if one or two of those Democrats aren't perfect on all the issues.
The other thing that they did effectively there, and this was came from the funders, there was some tough love. They said, you know, you're going to come to the table to all these special interest groups if you want to get funding. So that they did that. And I think that's part of the thing that we pull out in the book with the consultants near the end, where we talk with Andy Rappaport, who's part of the funding that's came about in this decade, and Democracy Alliance is part of this as well, is that the people that are funding the Democratic Party, you know, in these 527s, realize more than ever that we have to make these changes to the way things are done.
But in a way, Jerome, you're giving power back to those big wallet
people. I think we see it more as they are part of the progressive movement. You know,
this isn't a
thing where we're going to, you know, have a separations based upon, you know, who gives how much. They're not really given to the party. You know, there's a difference we have between the party and what's funded in terms of 527s and outside groups.
And the more regular people get involved and start, you know, help build these institutions and help support these candidates, it becomes a greater percentage of that pot. You still need the big money in a lot of ways to provide the support, to hire the to build the institutions of the vast left-wing conspiracy and hire people and those sort of things. You need that. We're not going to get away from that. But they're outside the party. They're not buying politicians. They're building a movement, and that's a dramatic difference.
Now, what about the Greens? What about the notion that there's a role to be played outside the Democratic Party for progressives? The Greens don't really show up in your book.
I voted for Ralph Nader in 96. How's that?
Gives you some cred, but...
Right. I have nothing good to say about Greens. I mean, well, they enabled this 8 years of George Bush.
Well, I do. I mean, I will say I'll stand up for the Greens a second because, you know, I'm for progressive action within the Democratic Party, outside the Democratic Party. You know, if you go back to Gore, and I know Nader's taken a lot of hits for Gore losing, but imagine what would have happened had, you know, Florida not been stolen. Gore would have won. Nader sitting there with his, you know, whatever, 2.7% of the vote, and that would have been, you know, a progressive coalition with weak pulling the Democrats to the left.
Yeah, it's a roll of the dice at the presidential level, and that's where I really, you know, sort of came of age and realized that. At the presidential level, I don't really think it – you're right. If it turns out right, we rolled the dice correctly. We gambled. It turned out great. But, you know, it didn't this time. We wound up with Bush. I think they're much more valuable with the local elections and getting Green people on there and advocating for, you know, a position that's progressive where they can actually win.
Yeah, you know, I look at 1964 and Barry Goldwater and the conservative movement, and they were blown out of the water. And there was a lot of talk back then of these conservatives forming a third party on the right, and the Democrat or the Republican Party back then was not the Republican Party of today. I mean, Richard Nixon created OSHA. He created the Environmental Protection Agency. This was a whole different world, and these conservatives were absolutely furious. But instead of starting a third party or working for a third party and splintering the right, they simply took over the existing party of the right, and that's what we're advocating. We're not saying, you know, screw you people on the left. We're saying take over the Democratic Party. It's there, and it's not as hard as it seems. I mean, people just have to show up to these county party meetings and state. People show up. You can take over the local parties, and you can work towards a more progressive Democratic Party.
That's Marcos of Daily Kos. Also here is Jerome Armstrong of MyDD.com. I'm Matt Rothschild of the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. What should the Democratic Party or your Democratic Party stand for? At one point in the book, toward the end, you write something that I really don't agree with, and maybe I'm misconstruing it. You say, at its core, this new movement is not ideological. Seems to me what you described then, even in the rest of that paragraph, is ideological. What is, why run from ideological terms or meanings, and what is it that the Democratic Party should stand for?
I think when we're referring to ideology, it's in contrast to the party in power. So it's an understanding that the Republicans approach things ideological. They believe that no matter what the problem is, that all we need to do is make more tax cuts, that we need to return to more traditional values, that we just need to pump more money in the military. And they approach these things with ideological blinders. And so what we're advocating for is more of a pragmatic approach to governing, which I think the Democratic Party, in large part, has done historically, that recognizes unique problems and ways to solve those that are with it approach is more pragmatic.
I mean, Marcos, you want to take a hit on that?
It's amazing this, Republicans love to talk about Ronald Reagan, enacting the largest tax cut in history. But they don't like to talk about it. Then he enacted two of the largest tax raises in history because he realized, well, that didn't work very well. We had these huge deficits. We need to start cutting into those deficits. There was a Republican Party that used to be more pragmatic and used to adapt and change its tactics depending on reality. George Bush and the modern Republican Party is completely incapable of that. But ultimately, within the Democratic Party, we have to realize that we are a big-time party. I mean, if we sit there, we can't have Madison or Berkeley Democrats. They're not going to play in Tulsa, Oklahoma or Omaha, Nebraska. And if we're going to be a national party, we have to find those common principles that bind us. And they're not necessarily based on your traditional ideological tenets of the Democratic Party. A lot of it is just based on the values that drive us, values like fairness and opportunity and investing in people and in the future. And that's the sort of thing that we need to talk about more so than, ideology in a more stark and litmus test type of atmosphere.
I mean, that was the governor of Montana you quote in your book, Crashing the Gate, saying after you asked him basically the question I asked you guys, his answer was, we're on your side. That's our message. Yeah. As Democrats, if you're a Democrat. But the Iraq War is a divisive issue, for instance, and the one thing that unites most of the progressive blogosphere seems to me is opposition, pretty strong opposition to that war.
That unites Americans nowadays.
We point that out too. I think, we have to draw a distinction here of what's recognized as traditionally as ideology and values. We're not advocating that the Democratic Party doesn't have values. And in many ways, we believe that the strategy and tactics that we advocate for value people. The Democratic Party will have slogans like putting people first or things that are people powered, but they really, when it comes to the election time, will adopt a battleground mentality that looks at only a few states and discards half the people in the nation. Mm-hmm. So our values come from realizing that we want to be a national party and we need to get people throughout the nation involved within the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I think the more people realize what we stand for, they're going to realize that Democrats share American values, very core American values. And a lot of it when we talk about ideology too is this kind of Democratic fixation on issues. We want to talk issues. We want to appeal to people in their brain, in their intellect. We want to show them pie charts about how horrible the deficits are. They're hitting people in the gut. They're making an emotional, visceral reaction. So, finally, we're seeing Democrats better at that. When they asked Nancy Pelosi, why do we have $3 gasoline? She said, well, you put two oil people in the White House. What did you expect?
We're going to have to leave it there. Fascinating conversation. That was Marcos of Daily Kos. And also on the program, you heard a lot from Jerome Armstrong of MyDD.com. Thanks for listening to Progressive Radio.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.